is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhim in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The economy is harsh. People cannot afford even to take basic precautions like social distances because of the necessities for them to stay alive and survive under this harsh economy.
That's Sanili Moyo, a 40-year-old who was vaccinated but still contracted COVID-19 in Zimbabwe. Details coming up. Also, press reports indicate former President Alpha Conde has left Guinea, and Nigerian authorities say the military is responding to gunmen who are killing and kidnapping people in the country's northwest. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Central Council for the Forces of Freedom and Change, a prominent Sudanese pro-democracy group, has conditionally accepted the UN's offer to broker an end to political deadlock following the October military coup. However, another key civilian group, the Sudanese Professionals Association, has rejected the UN offer. Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at Africa Center of the Atlantic Council, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi the prospects of mediation success in Sudan.
Well, I think we have to look at the context that this mediation is taking place in. On the streets of Khartoum today, there have been another 7 people killed by the military, unarmed civilians protesting for democracy. And so the military is right now holding the country hostage. And so we're negotiating with a group of people who no longer have the legitimacy, I think, to be a part of this civilian government. And so when you ask about the divisions within the FFC, or with the pro-democracy groups, I think there is a question about whether or not the military can actually play any role whatsoever as part of a transitional government to full civilian rule. That is the question, I think, the question that the international community is also grappling with, because they have made the military a partner in this arrangement. But how can you have a partner in government which one day is killing people and the next day negotiating its political outcome? It's very difficult to square these two facts on the ground, and I think that's what people are struggling with right now.
David Satterfield, the new U.S. envoy to the Horn of Africa, is visiting Sudan this week, where he and U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molifi, will meet military and political figures as well as pro-democracy activists. Could that U.S. move facilitate a renewed civilian-led transition to democracy in Sudan?
I think only if the United States comes prepared to put pressure on the military. Thus far, the military has suffered no consequences, no punitive measures, either for the coup d'etat on October 25th or for the killing of now more than 70 pro-democracy activists on the ground. And so unless the United States decides that it is ready to impose sanctions on military generals who have ordered the killing, who have ordered the shooting and the use of snipers against innocent civilians on the ground, unless they are prepared to do that, then I don't believe that the United States is going to be able to rebalance the negotiations in favor of a civilian government. There's just no possibility. As long as the military continues to believe that their actions will meet with no international consequences, I think they will continue on the course that they are on, which will only lead to more bloodshed and division within the country.
In a recent article, you called for a tougher U.S. stance, and you said, beyond punitive measures, Washington needs a more active role in shaping an outcome that meets the demands of the Sudanese people, supports U.S. strategic interests in the region, and reflects President Joe Biden's own commitment to democracy and human rights. Can you explain how?
Well, I mean, I think it requires a full-on strategy that the United States has yet to demonstrate that it has. Both a strategy for the immediate response to the crisis in Sudan, the political crisis and the security crisis being faced by pro-democracy protesters, but then also a strategy that leads us through this transition to elections and what we want Sudan to look like coming out of those elections, what role we want the military to play, and most importantly, what the Sudanese want their country to look like. We have some sense of that, but we really need a strategy to lead us through the next 3 years. And that's a strategy of diplomatic engagement. It's using our development assistance, our security assistance, and all the tools in our diplomatic toolkit. That's what we need to figure out, how to use and when to use those resources. We simply do not have that roadmap that gets us from 2022 until elections and civilian rule and democracy in 2024 and beyond. And that's what I'm talking about.
That was Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at Africa Center of the Atlantic Council, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Al-Shanawi. According to the Associated Press, former President Alpha Conde has left Guinea to seek medical treatment in the United Arab Emirates. There was no immediate confirmation from the junta-led transitional government on his departure. Officials announced earlier this month that the 83-year-old Conde was not in good health and would be traveling abroad soon for care. Conde was ousted from power last September, less than a year after he won a third term despite widespread protests. The ex-president had backed a constitutional referendum bending the term limit rules. The regional bloc ECOWAS and other members of the international community have called for Conde's immediate release ever since he was detained in September coup that overthrew him after more than a decade in power. Nigerian authorities say the military is responding to a series of killings and kidnappings by gunmen in the country's northwest. In the latest attack, gunmen on motorcycles Saturday raided a village in the Kebbi state, killing at least 50 people, according to locals. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
President Muhammadu Buhari's senior aide, Garba Shehu, said on Twitter Sunday that the president has ordered the military to, quote, respond robustly to the cases of killings and kidnappings, end quote. He added, quote, the federal government is willing to strengthen support and cooperation of all states, end quote, and said the president believes that with the full cooperation of the citizens, Nigeria will surely overcome this problem. It is not the first time the president has issued strong worded threats against armed gangs in the country, known locally as bandits. But gangs continue to raid communities, looting for supplies, and killing and kidnapping for ransom, mostly in the northwest and central regions. The latest incident occurred in Dankeda village in Kebbi state over the weekend. More than 50 people were reportedly killed. Last week, more than 200 people were killed in attacks that lasted 3 days in northwestern Zamfara state. However, security analyst Kabiru Adamu says recent efforts by authorities are paying off.
Since the president renewed his call to the security forces, and what we've seen is military airstrikes in forests where these bandits, they're holding their victims. We've also seen an increase in police operations. So all of that has affected the ability of this groups, these bandits, these gunmen, to operate.
Late last year, Nigeria officially classified armed gangs as terrorists, putting them in the same category as Boko Haram and Islamic State West Africa Province, ISWAP. Experts say the designation was a major step in taking deterrent measures against the groups. Senator Irebu is a security analyst.
The attack doesn't also diminish that fact that, yes, there's progress. The terrorists' capacity has greatly been diminished. So there are definitely progress from what it used to be.
Nigeria's armed forces said last week they killed 537 armed bandits and other criminal elements in the region and arrested 374 others since May of last year. It said 452 kidnapped civilians have been rescued. Still, the armed forces are struggling to maintain basic security. More than 10,000 people were killed in Nigeria in banditry and terror-related attacks last year, according to the U.S.-based Council for Foreign Relations. This month, Nigeria received clearance to deploy fighter jets purchased from the United States after months of delay due to human rights concerns. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
South Africans are outraged after the country's national energy company Eskom asked the government to approve a massive 20% rate hike. If Eskom gets its way, the hike will kick in almost immediately, causing more suffering and a population already reeling from high unemployment and an economic depression intensified by the COVID-19 pandemic. Many South Africans consider the proposed increase in power costs to be deeply insulting, given that Eskom's battling to keep their lights on. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa's been plagued by frequent blackouts for almost 15 years. Its aging coal-fired power stations are crumpling under the pressure of providing electricity to 60 million people and the continent's most industrialized economy. The government's built two new power plants, but they don't work properly, allegedly because the former administration under Jacob Zuma stole the money meant for proper installations and upgrades.
Some of the Eskom systems are not that efficient. We know that their energy availability factor is very wanting.
Professor Samson Mampweli is an energy expert at the University of Cape Town.
We know there are aspects around corruption. Eskom lost about 3 billion rand in corruption and fraud and things like that.
In that context, he says, it's understandable that South Africans feel Eskom doesn't deserve any more of their money, especially when it cannot provide them with a reliable electricity supply.
If you look at the situation in its totality, we are currently not getting value for money, but we can't really blame it on the current Eskom management. We can blame it on the previous two Eskom managements. The current Eskom management is trying their level best under a very difficult circumstances.
Fact is, says Mampweli, Zuma's incompetent managers, who allegedly looted Eskom on his behalf, left the company hollow and broken. He describes Eskom leaders asking for a 20% electricity price increase as utter desperation as they try to dig the company out of a financial black hole.
They can make some adjustments to ensure that they don't pass on some of these costs to the consumers, but their hands are quite tied. I can't see the price of electricity stabilizing to a greater extent in the next three financial years, unless in the next financial year the new methodology then kicks in and then protects the poor and the vulnerable.
Many South Africans are also flummoxed by the government's pumping of billions of rands into Eskom and its outdated and dirty coal technology, when the future of electricity generation clearly lies in independent energy companies producing clean power. To increase the possibility of big electricity outages in the near future, Eskom's about to shut down a major unit at the Coburg Power Station, Africa's only nuclear power facility near Cape Town. Eskom says this refueling will take 6 months. This has left nuclear energy analyst Peter Becker in shock.
Refueling must happen every 18 months. Now it's 14 months since it was last refueled. So there's actually no need to take it offline at all at the moment. It could run for another 4 months odd. So what's the rationale for spending 20 to 40 billion on doing this job without even knowing whether the plant will run beyond 2024?
Coburg's almost 40 years old and its license is up for renewal in 2024. The government has, however, previously indicated it could close the station because of the expense and danger involved in running it. Since 2005, there have been several crises at Coburg, including fires and damage to nuclear reactors. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's government is urging the public not to panic amid an upsurge in COVID-19 deaths. Arigando gives us more on the story.
The chief coordinator of the COVID-19 task force, Agnes Mahomba, has urged citizens not to panic over the upsurge in the number of deaths from the respiratory diseases over the past few weeks. Minister of Health statistics show the highest daily figure during the current surge was 28 deaths recorded on January 7. Observers say part of the reason for the rise in infections and deaths owes much to misleading early reports about the Omicron variant being highly transmissible but not as deadly. The World Health Organization recently warned against complacence over the new strain, saying it is just as deadly. VOA reached out to ordinary citizens to ask about their personal efforts and their reception of government efforts to combat the pandemic. Sanele Moyo is a 40-year-old mother of one who contracted the virus even though she was vaccinated. She says she is not surprised with the current wave of deaths and infections.
And yet we are still seeing overcrowding in these ZUPCO buses. We are still seeing queues in banks.
Moyo says while government imposes lockdowns and tells people not to panic, street scenes show reasons to be worried. Observers say what compounds the situation is the state of the economy, which compels people to resort to potentially life-threatening practices in a bid to eke out an existence. Moyo agrees.
The economy is harsh. People cannot afford even to take basic precautions like social distancing because of the necessities for them to stay alive and survive under this harsh economy. And the many of these deaths, honestly, they are not necessary. Some of them are just because of the poor health delivery system. Zimbabweans are still dying even from those mild symptoms because something as simple as just going to the hospital and getting attention, you know, it's just not there. And or getting oxygen, it even discourages people from going to hospital.
The Community Working Group on Health says curbing the spread of infections is everyone's responsibility and not just government. Itairo Sike with the group weighs in.
We continue to encourage Zimbabweans, you know, to play their part. The COVID-19 response is not just the responsibility of the health sector alone. It is now the responsibility of us as individuals, families, and communities. But most importantly, we also need to identify vaccine champions in our various communities so that they can encourage, you know, their followers, members, embrace the vaccines. And these vaccine champions can be traditional leaders, religious leaders, and any other people of influence.
On its part, the government recently rolled out a program to give booster shots to those who have already received two COVID-19 vaccine shots. But for VOA, Zadi Gondo in Blawaya, Zimbabwe.
Nigerian prosecutors have added new charges against separatist leader Namidi Kanu. He is, according to Reuters, the head of the Indigenous People of Biafra, IPOB, a group he founded in 2014 that is pressing for the secession of the Igbo ethnic group's homeland, which covers parts of southwest Nigeria. An attempt by the homeland to secede as the Republic of Biafra in 1967, the year that Kanu was born, killed more than 1 million people. Nigerian authorities view Kanu's IPOB as a terrorist group. They accused the group of mounting attacks last year at police stations and government buildings in the country's southeast. Namdi Kanu, a British citizen, was first accused of encouraging attacks on security forces. Now, prosecutors have served his lawyers with an amended charge listing 15 counts. It includes terrorism charges, calling for secession, and knowingly broadcasting falsehoods about President Muhammadu Buhari. Kanu has pleaded not guilty to all the charges. A new assessment of the global labor market finds that recovery from the employment crisis created by the COVID-19 pandemic will be fragile and will worsen inequalities between rich and poor countries. The projection comes in a new report from the United Nations International Labor Organization. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
ILO economists say labor markets are recovering from the pandemic-induced crisis much more slowly than previously expected. They project the number of global working hours this year will be 1.8% below the numbers of pre-pandemic hours worked in the last quarter of 2019. That deficit, they say, is equivalent to a loss of 52 million full-time jobs, twice as large as the number predicted in last year's global market survey. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says this shortfall in the labor supply comes on top of persistently high pre-crisis levels of unemployment.
In 2022, we project that global unemployment will stand at 207 million, and that's 20 million above the pre-pandemic level in 2019. Put in percentage terms, we expect the 2022 unemployment rate to be 5.9%.
The report finds a great divergence in recovery between regions. It says the European and North American regions are showing encouraging signs of recovery. The worst affected regions are Southeast Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Ryder says the richer countries are expected to emerge from this crisis in better shape than the poorer countries. He says a big gap exists between the labor market prospects of countries depending on their level of income and development.
Many low and middle income economies are struggling to get back to pre-pandemic levels of employment and of job quality. And insufficient access to vaccines is putting pressure on their healthcare systems, with tight fiscal space limiting the ability of their governments to use stimulus measures to support their labor markets.
Ryder says the International Labor Organization has not taken a policy position on the legitimacy or otherwise of vaccination mandates in the workplace. He says a fundamental problem facing work sites is the unequal access to vaccines. For him, he says, the bottom line is to ensure that people are able to work in healthy, safe environments. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It was a 1-1 draw between Cameroon and Cape Verde in yesterday's Africa Cup of Nations match in Yaoundé, as Cameroon captain forward Vincent Aboubakar scored his fifth goal in the tournament. And Ndaye Mulamba holds the record for the most goals by an individual in the flagship African tournament with 9 for Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that was 48 years ago. Aboubakar has a clear lead in most goals in the Golden Boot competition with compatriot Karl Toki Kambi, Tunisian Wahabi Kazri, Malian Ibrahim Kohn, and Malawian Frank Mahango scoring 2 goals each. Cameroon heads the final group table with 7 points. Burkina Faso aided Cape Verde on head-to-head records for second place after both accumulated 4 points. Ethiopia was eliminated with just 1 point. In today's matches, in Group B, Zimbabwe faces Guinea and Malawi plays Senegal. In Group C, it's Gabon versus Morocco and Ghana faces Comoros. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Bokmilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music
from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.